So it's my great pleasure now to introduce to Lawrence Lessig. Lawrence Lessig is the Roy L. Foreman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. Prior to returning to Harvard, he taught at Stanford Law School, where he founded the Center for Internet and Society, and at the University of Chicago. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia at the United States Supreme Court. He holds a Bachelor of Arts in Economics and a Bachelor of Science in Management from the University of Pennsylvania, and a Master in Philosophy from Cambridge University and a Juridical Doctor from Yale. Lawrence Lessig is the founder of Equal Citizens and a founding board member of Creative Commons. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Philosophical Society and has received numerous awards. Cited by The New Yorker as the most important thinker on intellectual property in the internet era, Lessig has turned his focus from law and technology to institutional corruption, relationships which, while legal, weaken public trust in an institution, especially as that affects democracy. He's known for being a proponent of reduced legal restrictions on copyright, trademark, and radio frequency spectrum. Founding Creative Commons, he devoted himself to expanding the range of creative work available for others to build upon and to share legally. His papers deeply impressed us. Let me name only They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy in 2019, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy 2008, The Future of Ideas 2001, and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace in 1999. With your focus, you were one of the first legal scholars strongly criticizing the development within the law of cyberspace. Your works largely influenced the research in this field until today. Standing for reduced legal restrictions on copyrights and reclaiming democracy, we were very curious about your thoughts on possibly constituting a human data society. Thank you for following our invitation and for coming to Constance. The floor is yours.
So I'm going to use new technology but old eyes, so I need new glasses. I'm grateful, Professor Werner, for your invitation. And Rector Holzinger, it's wonderful to have you here to celebrate this launch. And I wanted to approach the question of your center from a particularly legal perspective. I titled my talk, The Constituting of the Human Data Society. And I want to emphasize the idea that we need to think about the building, the constituting. And in particular, that we think about the way so that we humans retain the capacity to control it. Or we could say control IT, that rather than IT meaning the data side of this equation controlling us, we sustain a capacity to direct how society survives within the context of this data environment. Now, I confess, from the United States, it seems like this just might be too late. We might be too far down this path to actually have the capacity to reclaim the sovereignty to direct how we develop. If we think about the concept of instrumental rationality, and we map it across time and across different levels of instrumental rationality, we humans have had a pretty good run, dominating maybe not every species or better than every species. I've just learned how to be a beekeeper, so I'm very impressed with bees. But in the main, humans are pretty good at crafting a purpose and seeking and achieving that purpose. Corporations are better. They can maximize or achieve instrumental objectives more efficiently, more consistently. And they have helped evolve AI technologies, which are themselves better Now, with each of these layers, we aspire to control the higher layer. So through democracy, we imagine we control corporations. And corporations imagine through management that they are controlling AI. But these images of control are too often fantasies. Often, AI runs ahead of the objectives of the corporation. In 2017, Facebook was embarrassed to acknowledge that its AIs had developed an advertising category called Jew haters, which enabled people to buy the eyeballs, the attention of Jew haters, because the AI technology determined that would be profit maximizing. And of course, there was no engineer, no human who actually made that choice. It was the technology, yet the humans had lost control of the technology. Or more dramatically, in the United States in particular, we imagine we control the corporations control our democracy. This is a map of the rise in corporate donations in the political sphere. Now, the single most important influence over funding of campaigns comes from these large, largely corporately funded super PACs that make it increasingly difficult to imagine that it is we who are controlling them rather than them who are controlling us. So in this field, we might see that instrumental rationality begins to yield in the direction of the most effective. And the question we should be asking is how we can restore control. We may have lost control already, but if it is not too late, if it's not too late to control this technology, we need to develop that capacity. We need to develop a capacity to regulate data, which I'm going to describe as to regulate code. Okay, the idea of regulating code is sometimes taken literally. Sometimes when the claim is made that we need a better way to regulate the technologies, people think we need to literally specify technologies, for example, protocols that must be used. But to regulate code does not mean literally regulating the code. For example, in the context of the debate about network neutrality, what regulating to achieve network neutrality should mean is not regulating the protocols, as if the government can specify which particular protocols should be running on a network. More efficient would be for the government to be regulating the business models of those who are providing the network, so that those models don't build in the incentives to build a network contrary to the values that we as a society should be defending. To regulate code is to assure, to sustain a control over the code by regulating to produce the incentives to preserve these values most efficiently and most effectively. Now, in my view, the best example of how this could be done or how this will be done is in the context of privacy. Right now, the fight over privacy is often framed as a fight over data. Who controls my data? And when it's framed like that, there's a certain obvious answer to it. Obviously, me. I should be controlling my data. Privacy is, in this sense, about my control over my data. And I want to suggest I think that's completely wrong. That's not how we should think about privacy. That would be bad privacy. It would be no privacy because, in effect, it gives total control to data. To see this, I think it's valuable to draw certain lessons from what feels like a very old fight right now, fight around copyright. So allow me to take you back 20 years in the history of the internet. So around the 2000s, in the United States especially, we saw the birth of the copyright wars. Technologies such as these file sharing technologies became the target of an industry association, the RIAA, in the United States. Because the RIAA in the middle 1990s discovered the internet. They discovered that there was a technology that perfected the ability freely to copy and to distribute content without control. And they were terrified at this technology. Because the idea of copies of content being available freely across the internet was, of course, inconsistent with their conception of their own business model. So they adopted a strategy in response. The strategy was to control the copies. They developed a suite of technologies we refer to as digital rights management technologies, and those technologies sought to lock down the copies, to lock down the capacity to spread content broadly. And we saw an explosion of technologies to control copies. The most dramatic, astonishing, were technologies like Content ID that made it trivially easy to identify copies on platforms like YouTube and to therefore regulate access once those copies were noticed. Now, in my view, this way of addressing the problem of copyright in the context of digital technologies was a mistake. Because, of course, yes, we need a system to assure that artists are compensated. But an unintended consequence of this particular system was to increasingly disable artists from using this platform in a way that allowed them to create and share their art. Because this massively efficient technology to scan and block content began to produce these absurd consequences, disabling people from creating and making their work available because of these types of technology. So for example, here's one extreme story.
In this video about licks, I'm playing a tiny lick of an Eagles song, just one lick. I'm not playing the last note. And now this video is completely blocked for viewers in the United States, where coincidentally my biggest public is. And all the advertising money the video is making from the rest of the world goes to them. Everything, not 1 cent for me. So for a 2 second lick, 8 little notes, in a freaking 15 minute long video, doesn't matter. The rest of the video doesn't matter.
Now, Paul Davids is a guitar teacher, and he's using the platform of the internet to help others learn how to play the guitar. But as he teaches them how to play the guitar, he has to teach them what the guitar sounds like. And as he does that, as he teaches, his music is then compared to this other database of Content ID music, and he is disabled because there are copies discovered in this music. And YouTube is now littered with channels that have been shut down because of this massively big and efficient technology for identifying these copies and facilitating the blocking of access to anyone producing or making them accessible. Now, when you look at that problem and you think, well, how could we have done it better? How could we do it better? The simple answer, I think, is that we stop regulating copies of content and start regulating uses. So by uses, I mean the particular way in which the creative work has been deployed. So for example, if we think about the difference between literally copying some music or modifying it, a remix of the music, and we think about the difference between a context which is a commercial context and a context which is a non-commercial context. The core of copyright should be regulating copies of commercial work, uses that are effectively copies in a commercial context. And by contrast, remixes in a non-commercial context, your kids taking music, making remixes, sharing it with their friends, that should be outside of the scope of copyright's control. And between these two extremes, there are harder cases. So commercial remixes, derivative works, or derivative efforts to take work and make it into something different, has a mix of regulation and freedom that's necessary to assure and inspire that type of creativity. And non-commercial copies, you know, sharing a song with your 10,000 best friends, that shouldn't be completely unregulated, but likewise, it shouldn't be locked down in the mechanical sense that DRM locks it down. And in these contexts, what I mean by this is regulated just simply means compensated. So that we begin to compensate in the domains where the usage should be regulated and not elsewhere. Now, the key to this strategy is that we are ignoring the thing, the copy, to focus on the use. That rather than attempting to use the law to control the technology that facilitates the copies and obsessing on the copy, we use the law to identify where regulation is needed to achieve the values the law legitimately has, and those values are to assure artists are compensated. Okay, that's the fight from 20 years ago. I want to suggest it's exactly the same fight in the context of data. 2020s, we now are not in the middle of copyright wars, we're in the middle of the privacy wars. Companies like these are gathering extraordinary amounts of data about their users, and now it's the consumers who are terrified by the dynamic that's being developed here. All of this data gathering is driven by a particular business model of the internet. And that business model is a business model of advertising. 20 years ago, the idea that the internet would be driven by advertising was completely anathema. Nobody imagined how it would be possible. But today, this is the source of the gold. And the objective to gather data to facilitate efficient advertising is the overwhelming objective of each of these dominant platforms on the internet. Now, the key here is that the data that is being used to facilitate this advertising is made. It's not just found. It's not as if YouTube is just sitting there and passively watching cars on a highway. They're not just collecting information about us. They are actively poking and tweaking and asking us questions, rendering us vulnerable through the incentives their platforms create, reaching down the brain stack, leveraging our insecurity so that we reveal more about ourselves. That is exactly how Facebook and Instagram work, by making us feel less secure, so that we want to show more. Why isn't my life as happy and beautiful as my friend's life? Or why aren't my kids as amazing as musicians as Liana's kids might be? This is the dynamic that this platform induces because it knows that insecurity will drive you to engage more. And so as the platform develops that insecurity, we do more, we engage more, we reveal more so that they see more, all for the simple purpose of better selling ads. This is the business model of surveillance capitalism as Shoshana Zuboff has described it. And I think this model must be our understanding of how and why the platform is developing as it develops right now. And this triggers a certain panic and a certain resistance. And it's striking, at least outside of the United States, how powerfully that resistance is growing. Obviously, the GDPR is triggered in part by this reality. California has tried to copy the best of the GDPR. Apple has tried to identify it as the company fighting against this surveillance capitalism. But this resistance has a form, and the form is to regulate data. And I want you to think now back to the copyright wars and recognize the parallel I'm trying to draw. Just like they regulated copies, now we think about regulating data. And we do that by first effectively affirming the individual owns his or her data and companies get to use that data only with permission. This structure is the structure of empowerment and choice. The law empowers us by assigning us rights and gives us a choice about how then our data will be used. Now, empowerment and choice is kind of what we would refer to in the States as motherhood and apple pie. No one could be against empowerment and choice. No one is, no one could be against this idea, except let me suggest I am against empowerment and choice. And I'm against empowerment and choice because of what empowerment and choice looks like in reality, how it actually manifests itself in the society we live within. So here, the pictures, this wonderful site collects terms of service, the expression of empowerment and choice for these dominant sites. We begin to see the extent of empowerment and choice that we all have in these sites. Here's a nice calculation of the average time it would take to read the terms of service for Microsoft, 63 minutes. Spotify, 35 minutes. Pokemon Go, 35 minutes. TikTok, 31 minutes. Now, the idea that anybody actually reads that, of course, is absurd. No one engages in that kind of analysis. But my point is, even if you did, would you even understand what you're reading? Would you understand the implications of what you're reading? And would you understand the interactions of the implications of what you're reading for the six different platforms you happen to be engaging with in any moments of your life, and understand then the implications of the co-ownership of those platforms, Instagram and Facebook and WhatsApp, all owned by the same company. Now, the point is, this is a general phenomenon, not just in the context of data. We all live our life lying every single day. We confront a million of these questions as we exist on the internet. Indicate you have read and agreed to the terms and conditions of privacy policy. And we live life through that lie. I, as a kid, was an obsessive truth teller, kind of perverse and weirdly so. But I would always, always tell the truth. Never, never would I lie. And then I have to live this life now where I can't do anything without constantly lying. It's like the Soviet Union in the 1980s and 1970s. You can't exist without living, practicing this experience of the lie. And I think we need to recognize how corrosive and corrupting that is for a culture, constantly to affirm what you know is not true as a way to celebrate this value we say we are protecting called privacy. If that's what it means to protect a value, we have no values we are protecting, because that is to deny that there is a value we are protecting when we know we lie about the elements of its protection. And anyway, it is completely ineffective in protecting privacy. It is both too protective and not protective enough. Okay, so too protective. Alex Pentland, professor at MIT, in 2014, wrote this book, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread and Lessons from a New Science. Wonderful book about the dynamics of data. But he tells this really striking story about cell phones. Remember, this is 2014. He writes, but mobile phone data show that it's not true. People reliably change their behavior when they become ill. With reported sore throat and cough symptoms, we found that people's normal patterns of socialization were disrupted, and they began to interact more and with more and different people, good for the virus but bad for humans. And it's possible, he says, to actually classify people's overall health state from their behavior alone. And then the punchline, the ability to track disease such as the flu against individuals would give us real protection against pandemics because we could take steps to reach infected people before they spread the disease further. So what he is saying is, just looking at the behavioral data with the cell phones, we would have a capacity to identify the likely locations of the emergence of influenza or other diseases like that, especially in the context of a pandemic. So these data would give us that capacity if researchers or public health officials could have easy access to those data. But of course, that power depends upon access to the data. And right now, there can be no presumptive access to the data because of the empowerment and choice infrastructure that we have built within the context of most of these data. So to use these data to control something like a pandemic in the way in which Pentland is describing is not feasible because of the unintended consequence of this protection in this form for privacy. So that's a sense of which is too protective, then it's not protective enough. So imagine a platform that has the ability to monitor, as most of the platforms you use, the pattern of your interactions with the platform. And imagine the platform developed a way to learn from the difference in how you interacted with the platform, that you have a likely emerging cognitive disease, just simply by seeing the way in which you've typed differently. Now that power is out there, that capacity is out there. And imagine the platform then strikes a deal with an insurance company to say, we'll just tell you, we'll give you a little clue about which of our users are likely to be developing this cognitive disease. And of course, the insurance company then cancels or withdraws or raises the insurance rates for those particular users. Now, that's completely possible with technology right now. And depending on the platform, it may or may not violate privacy policy, but the point is the same type of technology could be available for purely static text, which is published and made accessible freely on the web. Purely public text, which gives the technology a capacity to infer a private fact from this public information. Now the point is that use of that data would not be regulated under the ordinary privacy rules that we have of empowerment and choice, because it's revealed not in a context where any privacy protection would attach to it. And I suggest if that's true, then the system of empowerment and choice is not protective enough. So the point is, in both cases, I'm making the same point. Privacy is not a function of data. Privacy is a function of uses. Privacy is about identifying the uses that we don't want automatically others to have. And privacy is about identifying the uses that we have no reason not to allow others to make of our data. So let's think about these possible uses. Well, we could think about uses that benefit the user and uses that harm the user. And we could think about uses that benefit society and uses that harm society. Okay, so the first category, benefits users and benefits society. My favorite is the ability of Amazon to report to me which books I ought to be reading based on which books I have read. So here it's collecting all the books I buy, which is too many on Amazon, and it's noticing which ones I'm interested in right now, and it can easily tell me which ones I should be reading based on the ones I had been reading. That use, I want to submit, is beneficial to me and beneficial to society to the extent people like bookstores or even quasi-bookstores like Amazon. So that's category one. Category two benefits society but harms the user. So let's say there's a predator, a child predator, who, because of the way the data is used, can be identified by a platform or a technology, their pattern of interaction, with whom they're interacting, whatever. And so it's able to identify which of these users are predators versus which are not. That use of data, I would suggest, harms the predator. The predator's not happy that they've been identified. But society is happy that the predator has been identified. Then a third category would be harms the user and harms society. One of the most important and most troubling aspects of the gaming industry is that so much of their economy is driven by the ability to identify what's referred to as the whales, the people who can't help themselves. They can't stop themselves from spending thousands and thousands of dollars playing these games. And it's those whales that subsidize, through their addiction, the gaming of everybody else. And so the ability to identify them by triggering and understanding who they are is a use of data that harms them because they are exploited and harms society to the extent that the exploitation of them is something that we all suffer from. Okay. The most interesting category, the one that I think is least theorized and I think the most important to think through, are cases which plausibly benefit the user, but in aggregate harm society. So what would those be? These are cases where we give the user what the user says, this is what I want, but harm what we, or I think on reflection, the user themselves would say they want. So let's step outside of the data world for a second to get a clear sense of what this dynamic might look like. Think about the industry that gives us food like this. Okay, this is the processed food industry. You know, it's a very important, powerful industry, especially in the United States. At the core of this industry is a certain thing called food science. And what food science does is figure out the perfect mix of salt, fat, and sugar that they can put into every bit of processed food to make that food essentially irresistible. So you take one bite of the Doritos, you can't stop until the bag of the Doritos is gone. Now, what they're doing through this food science is exploiting evolution. Like, we have just evolved to be creatures that are particularly vulnerable to this perfect mix of salt, fat, and sugar. And they're exploiting evolution with the aim, obviously, to drive us to consume endless amounts of this food. With the consequence, of course, for many, and I can attest, many in my own country, of great trouble for the health of people in our society. Now, when you ask why do they do this, it's not because they hate us, these companies. It's not because these companies hate us that they produce food that is addictive and bad for us. Like, they would love to be able to produce food that's addictive and good for us. Indeed, this wonderful book by Michael Moss, Salt, Sugar, Fat, tells the story of these executives at these processed food industries who wake up one day and realize they're basically poisoning all of America. And then they go through this come to Jesus moment where we're going to make our food healthy, no longer make it so it's not going to be the stuff you want your kids to eat, but you want your kids to eat that. And of course, each of these food companies like Kraft go through a stage where they try to do this. And of course, nobody likes what they produce, so the market punishes them. And then these enlightened executives are fired and they move on and people in the companies go back to their old ways. Why? Because the market disciplines them to provide what sells the most. And what sells the most, it just so happens, is what's least profitable for our health. Their response is, it's just business. They're not trying to kill us. Now think of this dynamic where they're exploiting evolution to make money as body hacking. And once you see body hacking, you'll understand what brain hacking is. So this is Tristan Harris, who was a Google engineer, left Google when he realized exactly how damaging the digital platform worlds were, started the Center for Humane Technology to help us focus on a different science that data science deploys, a science to learn how to engineer attention. So as to overcome resistance, the natural resistance all of us would have to spending our time on digital devices, and overcome resistance by exploiting evolution again. So we've evolved to be creatures who are particularly responsive to random rewards. Just so happens that's what triggers us. Or we've evolved to be creatures who can't stop feeding from endless wells of content. We just can't. We just are overwhelmed, and this is how we respond. And so they take advantage of these psychological features of us and others to develop platforms that draw us in, all with the aim to gather data to sell ads. Okay, now the consequence of what they do, the consequence of these platforms, is profound. It has real effects. So think about the Facebook news feed. The news feed has individual effects. Some people find themselves addicted. There's depression from the news feed and other similar feeds in Instagram and TikTok. The fear of missing out, depression, which is driven by these platforms, a suggestion of increased rise in suicide, especially among teen girls from these platforms. Those are, we could think of individual effects for the individuals using these. And they're social effects. Because these platforms are architected in a way to isolate us and make us vulnerable to the inducements to engagement that these platforms provide. As Zeynep Tufekci puts it, the companies are in the business of monetizing attention. That's their business. And not necessarily in ways that are conducive to health or to the success of social movements or the public sphere. And this dynamic drives a certain politics of hate that we've seen spread across the world, but especially in places like Britain and the United States. Because it just turns out, too bad for us, but it just turns out that if they can make us polarized and ignorant about politics, it is most profitable to them. The more they can drive us into bubbles and rile us up at our hatred for the other side, convince us that the other side is not just the other side, but they are the enemy, the traitors, the people who need to be removed from the political sphere. The more they can do that, the more we will engage with their platform. This, like with potato chips, is an unfortunate fact about us, that this is the way they make the most money. But this is the way they make the most money. And it is therefore the reality that these platforms are deployed in ways that have this effect, even though the owners of the platforms are not trying to destroy democracy. They just happen to be destroying democracy. This is to point to the certain externality to social data, an externality that, unfortunately, we are particularly vulnerable to, and it's not clear how we can respond to easily. So this is the category I want to think of as benefiting users and harming society. It's benefiting the user because the user is just getting what the user wants. Like I'm choosing to get this news feed or to opt into these particular groups or to go down this rabbit hole on TikTok. I'm saying yes to this and yes to this and yes to this. But in the aggregate, we can see the way it's harming important domains of society, even if it's great for selling books on Amazon or shoes of Nike, it's terrible for facilitating the dynamics of democracy. We can like it individually, we should collectively hate it. Now, the point then is none of these different dynamics in each of these four boxes is appropriately regulable by thinking about data as the target of regulation. Instead, each of these is identifiable by thinking about the uses which this particular interaction is facilitating. And like with copyright, I think we can see a similar pattern of green light and red light uses. The Amazon Books category are the kinds of uses of data that we should be encouraging, and especially those which facilitate the better understanding of public goods and the needs to advance public goods. And these other categories are uses that should be more deeply regulated as uses, to abolishing completely the exploited addict cases. But then in the cases of harming user and benefiting society, or harming society and benefiting users, a more subtle and careful balance of the use and its regulation. These differences are not a function of choice. It's not a function of data. It's simply the function of use. Okay, now, to achieve that regulation, the regulation of use, to build the capacity to make it possible to have that kind of regulation is not easy. The infrastructure of governance that would be necessary to do this, to build confidence, in how companies are using data, how data is properly being protected, which uses are effectively disabled because of that regulation. The capacity to do this is difficult to build. My own view is if we could build it, and I agree, it's a big if, but if we could build it, then that would repair an incredibly important weakness that, at least within my society, we are constantly forced to reflect upon, the weakness in our own capacity to govern. If we could repair this, it's a way to imagine strengthening democracy's control in context of corporations, or even management's control in the regulation of AI. That would be a critical achievement. And it would be a critical and valuable achievement to achieve somewhere. Because this capacity, this ability, this vision that I'm describing, the ability to regulate uses rather than talk about the regulation of data, this capacity does not exist anywhere, at least anywhere within the United States right now. Because in the United States right now, governance has been disabled. We have turned ourselves over to the choices of the corporations, and the corporations have turned increasingly their own governance over to the logic of the AIs. And we should reflect that when governance is disabled, that does not mean no one has control. There is always control in every society. The only choice is whether that control is by humans or whether that control is by the data. Now, my plea is that we think about the development of this human data society, recognizing that we are the weaker in that partnership. We are the less powerful in that partnership because we don't understand fully how we can deploy these infrastructures of intelligence and keep control. And at every stage, our insistence should be, how have we assured our control over these infrastructures we built? And the means to do this are not hard to see immediately in front of us. Building transparent AI, or AI that reads back its logic in ways that humans can understand, is an obvious step. Building systems that refuse to allow black box technologies to have dominance over important domains of human and social interaction is an obvious next step. But the objective of building a center that keeps many perspectives together should include the perspective of governance, and to assure that in the infrastructure that is being built, the ideals of democratic governance survive. And those ideals are the ideals of assuring that whatever world we constitute, there are values it must defend. There are values that must inhere in it. And if we allow it to develop on its own without that critical intervention at every stage, then it will not develop in ways that protect those values. It will develop in ways that protects the instrumental rationality of the system itself. And that's not a human society. That's a data society. Thank you very much for your invitation and your attention.